This is Jean Ballant with the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. I'll be helping to moderate and host today's session. Again, I can hear people coughing, so please, please hit star 6 to mute your phone line right now. Even if you think your mute button is working, hit star 6, please. Thank you. I wanted to welcome everyone to today's Clue and Internet Seminar, which is starting just a few minutes late due to some technical glitches, which I apologize for. Today's session is a NARPM Presents seminar, which will cover vapor intrusion issues at the Hill Air Force Base. And it's been sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. If you're on the phone line, again, we would remind everyone, if you were having problems accessing the slides through a web browser window, we have fixed that problem. So if you go back to the seminar homepage and click refresh and click the button that says go to seminar, you can now check yourself in online and look at the slides online. If you're on the phone line, please mute your phone line. If you don't have the mute button, hit star 6. We'll be saving questions till the end of the presentation, and at that point you can take yourself off of mute. I'll provide instructions on how to do so at that time. But until then, keep yourself on mute or hit star 6 now to mute your line. Do not put the call on hold. There could be commercials or background noises or advertisements that could be disruptive. So again, if you need to hang up or take another call, certainly do so. There won't be any tones. There will be no disruption. You can dial back in at any time without us hearing anything. Just be sure to keep that phone call on mute, and I thank you all in advance for your cooperation with that. For those of you who are streaming the audio online, again, you may have had some difficulties checking in initially. If you're hearing my voice, hopefully you've gotten past that check-in screen problem. If you haven't, again, if you go back to the seminar homepage, we've fixed that issue. Simply refresh your web browser window, click the button to go to seminar. You can check in, and you'll be able to stream the audio online. When we go through today's PowerPoint presentation, every participant will be expected to manually move through their materials at verbal cues by the instructors. So everyone should have been looking at slide number 1, which is our title slide, and I'll ask you to move along to slide number 2, which is a housekeeping slide.
Good morning. Keep
moving to the slide.
Well, the first slide.
And again, please mute your phone line. I can hear that side conversation. The woman and the gentleman who are talking about the slides, I can hear you. Please hit star 6 to mute your phone. And I am talking about you because you still haven't muted your line. Again, star 6, if you could please press that on the phone.
Jane, that's mine and Sandra's.
Okay,
all right. We're working on some technical difficulties over here.
Okay, thank you guys, just making sure. For those of you, again, who are listening by phone, the questions will be held until the end of the presentation material, and then we'll allow you to unmute and ask questions. If you're streaming the audio online, you won't be able to ask questions out loud, but you can type up those questions or make a comment electronically. If you're looking at the slides through a web browser window, you'll see numbered links that appear on the left-hand side. You can use those links to jump to the appropriate slide as we go through today's PowerPoint presentation. But you can also use the orange buttons that appear along the top of the slide. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. If you click the orange button with the question mark icon in it, as long as your pop-up blockers are disabled, a new window will open up, and you can actually type up a comment or question and submit that to us electronically. Again, we're going to hold all of the questions until the end of the presentation, but you can certainly type up your comments or questions as soon as they occur to you. You don't have to wait until the end. And, in fact, we would suggest you type up the question as soon as it comes to your mind, and then that way when we get to the point for Q&A at the end of the session, we'll be able to read out those submitted questions out loud on your behalf so that our instructors can answer them. You can also use that same question mark icon to report technical difficulties you may be having. Just be sure to include a telephone number to let our support staff know where they can reach you. Again, the option for streaming audio, if you didn't sign up for streaming audio in the first place, you won't have access to that option now. If you did sign up for it and you couldn't hear it before, the streaming audio is working now. So if you want to go back to the seminar homepage and refresh your browser window, you should be able to check in online and listen to the audio online. You'll see an orange button on the top of your slides that looks like a computer speaker. If you click that, that'll open up the online streaming options for you if you registered to participate in that way. Another reminder for everybody, today's session is being recorded, and it will be available in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. Cluin does archive all of our presentations, and we make them available on our archive training page. So if you go to cluin.org, you can actually, /live/archives, you can browse through the over 375 training classes we have available. For those of you who signed up today, you'll automatically receive an email as soon as that archive is available. So if you think today's session was useful or valuable, you can certainly forward that email on to anyone you think that would find it useful. I think with that, that is the end of the formal reminders I have for everyone today. Again, I apologize greatly for the technical difficulties we had in the beginning, but they have been fixed. If you're having any other problems, please email me offline or use the question mark button to report a technical glitch, and we'll work with you to make sure you can hear and see everything. Again, the PowerPoint slides and PDF materials have been up and available to download the entire time. So with the end of those reminders, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3, and I'm going to turn things over to our presenters in Region 8. Sandra?
All right, thank you, Jean. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to present to you today the case study on vapor intrusion for Hill Air Force Base site located in Utah. I just first of all want to point out that Hill Air Force Base is a DOD facility. It is an Air Force facility, and it is an NPL site, and as such, they are the lead. They are the lead agency in conducting the investigation and the remediation of the Superfund program. EPA and the Utah Department of Environmental Quality are the oversight agencies. We are the regulators participate in this capacity in terms of oversight. So I'd like to start off by acknowledging the contributions of this presentation by various Hill Air Force Base project managers, and in particular, Mr. Jared Case, Mr. Kyle Garner, and Mr. Eric Deffenmeyer. They have worked tirelessly and endlessly to address this vapor intrusion pathway, along with EPA and UDEQ. Okay, let's advance now to slide number 4, where I'll give you an overview of today's presentation. Our presentation is anticipated to last for about an hour or so. First, I will be speaking to you, and I will be covering a brief history of Hill Air Force Base. I will present a timeline of activities related to the indoor air program, discuss the conceptual site model for vapor intrusion, and I'm going to summarize the base indoor air program, including data. Also going to discuss the effectiveness of the vapor removal systems and the recommendations for optimizing the program, and discuss a little bit about the community involvement program at Hill Air Force Base. And then end up with closure and exit strategy. Then I'm going to turn it over to Annette Bernard, and she's going to get into the specific details of the case studies that have been done at the base in terms of identifying indoor sources, and in particular to the contaminant 12DCA. And she's also going to get into various case studies in terms of how we have been managing the variability that we see in vapor intrusion, variability in terms of temporal and spatial variability. Let's advance now to slide number 5. This is a base map which shows the current and historical hazardous substance activities at the base. Hill Air Force Base is an active military facility, and it has been since before World War II in the early 1940s. And it has been used extensively for aircraft maintenance. So we see a lot of historic waste management practices generally are associated with aircraft maintenance and other base activities. And as you can see from the diagram, most of the waste has been managed around the base boundaries. And as a result, most of the groundwater contamination starts around the base boundaries and then spreads out into the surrounding communities, of which there are 7. And you can see the various waste management areas fire training area, fuel storage area, various waste disposal area, metal plating shops, vehicle maintenance shops, and so forth. Now let's move on to slide number 6. This slide basically shows a timeline of the vapor intrusion program at Hill Air Force Base. We started in the mid-1990s, and now we are in 2011, so we've been working on this vapor intrusion pathway and issue for quite a while. However, the majority of our sampling began in early 2000. It started when we had a resident in from one of our operable units, operable unit 12, discovered some groundwater in his basement sump and sent in a request to Hill to have that water sampled along with the indoor air. And as a result, we finally saw some concentrations that caused some concern for the indoor air pathway. And hence, here we are today. But the bulk of the activities occurred in 2003 when EPA, UDEQ, and the Hill Air Force Base worked together and did a time-critical removal action to install a vapor removal system. To install the first vapor removal system at that home. In 2003, a number of things happened. We had our first vapor removal system. We had the action memo for the time critical removal action. And that is when Hill Air Force Base started up their community involvement program where they basically conducted base-wide mailings to solicit sampling from all the residences surrounding the base. Moving on to slide number 7, this diagram shows the conceptual site model for vapor intrusion. As you can see, the fate and transport of VOCs to residential indoor air at Hill Air Force Base, there's a number of mechanisms. Many of the contaminants from the groundwater or VOCs, and they have the potential to volatilize from the groundwater plume, migrate up through the overlying vadose zones by various mechanisms, and then create a potential health risk for residents. Let's move on to slide number 8. This is a pretty handy operable unit summary sheet. Which serves very handy for Annette and I, and also for community members, RAB members, and so forth. Because Hill Air Force Base is a 6,700-acre base, a very large base, we currently have a total of 15 operable units on the base that we're working with. This diagram shows 13, and we just recently added 2 more. And so from this slide, you can see the various affected communities for each operable unit, the contaminants of concerns associated with each operable unit, the cleanup actions that have been taken, the treatment systems that have been installed, and the current status of the CERCLA process that each operable unit is in. Moving on, and I just wanted to point out, The one line that shows the approximate homes in each OU. As you can see, so the major OUs for vapor intrusion at Hill Air Force Base, there's pretty much basically 4 major OUs where we have vapor intrusion, OU-5, OU-8, OU-10, and OU-12, mainly because we have the largest number of homes in those areas, and we have shallow groundwater contamination in those areas. Those are the major ones. The other OUs also, we see problems, but those are the major ones. Okay, let's move on to slide number 9, where I'd like to talk about the general investigation strategy that was chosen by Hill Air Force Base. Basically, Hill Air Force Base consulted with the Redfield site, which is located here in Colorado. They had experienced some vapor intrusion problems and kind of were ahead of us in the game. And so we consulted with them, and we developed a strategy based on their recommendation.
basically they recommended to Hill Air Force Base to do what we call a top-down investigation strategy as opposed to a bottom-up investigation strategy. The top-down approach involves taking or sampling the indoor air in the homes above the contaminated groundwater. So you're actually getting a real-time exposure concentration. And this seems to be a very favorable method with the residents and the community. And of course, we as the regulators, we like this approach as well. The bottom-up approach, as I said, would rely on subsurface data. For example, you would take a number of sorrel gas samples and do some subsurface sampling to kind of infer what the concentration would be in the home. So basically, if the concentration of the contaminants in the indoor air are above the mitigation action levels, then we put in a vapor removal system. Sometimes even if the concentration is less than the mitigation action level, if there is a detection and the resident requests a mitigation system, Hill will generally put the system in. Okay, let's move on to slide number 10, where I'd just like to give you some brief characteristics of the vapor intrusion at Hill Air Force Base, starting with the hydrogeology. Pretty much, we're having a vapor intrusion problem because we do have contamination in the shallow groundwater. And the depth to groundwater of most of our plumes that spread out into the communities is usually in the area of somewhere from 3 to 25 feet below ground surface. And we generally see silt and sand aquifers. So this provides the pathway for vapors to emanate from the groundwater source and get into the homes. Now, the actual VOC concentrations that we generally see in these groundwater plumes, which is attributing to vapor intrusion, is in the range of 10 to 100 parts per billion. At Hill Air Force Base, it is a military installation, and as I said, it is surrounded by a number of houses, and most of those, we have houses that have basements. 50% of the homes have basements, and about 50% of the homes do not have basements, and we have been seeing problems in both types of homes. Okay, moving on to slide number 11. As you can see, this chart shows concentration in micrograms per liter versus the contaminants of concern at Hill Air Force Base. The whisker boxes show the relative concentrations of these contaminants of concern. So as you can see, TCE, which is the most widespread contamination at Hill Air Force Base, is found in the largest concentrations in the indoor air, followed by 1, 2, DCA. And as I said before, the concentrations are generally between, in the groundwater, are generally between 10 to 100 parts per billion. Okay, let's move on to slide number 12, where I'll talk about the vapor intrusion program approach for sampling. As I said, we use the top-down approach where we actually take an indoor air sample, and that is to determine if exposure is occurring. We take a 24-hour sample, and we analyze it to EPA method TO15. We use project-dedicated batch-certified clean sewer canisters. And of course, before we go in and conduct the sampling, we work with the resident and conduct an intensive chemical inventory and inspection of the home, of the basement area, of the garage, and so forth, prior to sampling to make sure that we remove all potential indoor sources. So there's advantages and disadvantages to everything in life. So the advantages of this approach, of course, is that we actually have an exposure concentration. And the public really tends to like this method. Because the public, as well as the regulators, we like knowing exactly what the exposure concentration is. The disadvantage, of course, as I have kind of referred to, is that you have to then make the distinguishment in that exposure from what is actually an indoor source and what is actually coming from the subsource, from the subsurface or from the groundwater. Okay, let's move on now to slide number 13. Here you see a diagram of Hill Air Force Base and the groundwater plumes. The groundwater plumes are depicted in blue, and as you will notice, we have light blue circles around the groundwater plumes. That's basically the generalized affected area for vapor intrusion from each plume. There are approximately 2,900 homes surrounding the base in seven cities and approximately 300 on-base buildings. At least one indoor air sample has been collected from 1,820 of those 2,900 homes overlying the shallow groundwater contamination on the base. That's a lot of samples. The indoor air program has been focused on off-base residential areas primarily due to the shallow depth to groundwater and the potential risk. As I said before, in some areas, the water is only 3 feet below ground surface. Vapor intrusion sampling has been conducted on-base at areas such as the Patriot Hills housing area and several industrial buildings on the west side of the base. Basically, we have not seen any impacts to indoor air on base, and that is because the depth to groundwater on base is much deeper than it is off base because Hill sits on a plateau. So far, there's no major impacts to indoor air on base, so the major focus is off base in the residential area. 16% of the homes that we have sampled have resulted in TCE detections greater than the mitigation action level. Okay, let's move on to slide number 14, where I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about the project approach. Okay, as you can see from this slide, we have a list of our contaminants of concerns for the base, which is basically 9 contaminants of concern. TCE, as I said, is a major contaminant in the groundwater. And the mitigation, this slide also shows the mitigation action levels that were developed. These were collaboratively developed between Hill, EPA, and UDEQ. And we developed these using the EPA's draft vapor intrusion guidance, which came out in 2002. These mitigation action levels are based on a cancer risk of 1 times 10 to the negative 5 or a non-cancer risk or a hazard index of 1. Okay, let's move on now to slide 15, which basically shows a decision logic diagram for sampling vapor intrusion indoors. As you can see from the diagram, we sample the indoor air, and if any contaminant of concern is detected, and more specifically, if it's detected above our mitigation action levels, which I just presented to you, what we do is we do a source investigation because we want to rule out any and all indoor sources. So we do the source investigation, and if there is an interior source, then of course we're going to remove that interior source and then do follow-up sampling the next year. If there is a concentration above the mitigation action level is detected, We do our source investigation for indoor sources, and there we find that there is not an interior source. Then we know that we probably have a vapor intrusion problem, and we will proceed to install a vapor removal system and then follow up, of course, with performance monitoring for that vapor removal system. That's the basic logic. Okay, let's move on now to slide number 16. Well, I'll give you just the results of Hill Air Force Base's overall vapor intrusion program. As I said before, we've been working with this pathway since early 2000, since around January of 2001. We've taken a large number of indoor air samples, 1,820 samples. 1,820 homes have been sampled of the 2,900 homes that surround the base and that are affected. More than 7,500 samples have been collected. And TCE detections, we have seen TCE detections in 290 of the homes. That's 16% of the homes that we sampled. TCE has been detected above action level in 123 homes. And of that 123, 35 of these are known or suspected indoor sources. We have installed over 106 sub-slab depressurization systems or vapor removal systems. So this is a large program. It's a large program, and it takes a lot of time and effort to manage. Okay, let's move on to slide number 17. Okay, what I'd like to do is give you an example here of a typical year sampling for our vapor intrusion program at the base. And so I'd just like to discuss what we did for the year 2010, just give you a quick summary. Okay, we sent out letters to 2,710 homes. Of those, 633 actually agreed to let us come in and sample their indoor air. And as a result, we ended up sampling most of those homes. 630 of those homes were actually sampled. 77 homes then had detection. And this year, most of those detections were indoor sources. We were able to investigate and found that most of those homes were indoor sources, and most of those concentrations were from indoor sources and not from the subsurface, so therefore not a vapor intrusion problem. Okay, now let's move on to slide number 18, where I'd like to start talking about mitigation. How do we mitigate when we actually have a vapor intrusion problem that's coming from the subsurface, from the groundwater plumes? So if a contaminant is detected in indoor air above its mitigation action level, HIL typically recommends to the resident that a vapor removal system be installed. And these vapor removal systems are designed and installed to create a negative pressure. This negative pressure creates a vacuum in the subslab. And that vacuum in the subslab is used to determine if the system is operational and functional. If we do have that subslab vacuum, then we know our vapor removal system is operating as it should. They're also designed and installed to operate continuously. And we do not want to create any noise, pollution, or add additional hazards, such as backdrafting or disturbances of asbestos-containing building materials. I'd just like to point out that one of the advantages of installing these systems is that if there's a radon problem in the home, it will also, as a bonus, remediate that. So as you can see from the diagram, you can see that the suction point in this diagram is close to the basement wall. However, we basically almost always try to have the suction point located in the center of the basement. Because this helps us to manage the spatial variability beneath the sub-slab. Okay, move on to slide number 19, where I'm continuing to talk about mitigation. We have our vapor removal systems, which are basically sub-slab depressurization systems. And they have been effective when vapor intrusion is the actual source of vapors. The Air Force pays for the power to run these systems, and they pay for the maintenance of these systems, and of course they pay for the performance monitoring of these systems. The Air Force conducts annual inspections to ensure that these systems is operational and functional, to ensure that they're operating properly. They have to go out there every year and check. One of the other things that we found, in many cases, these systems will not be effective when we have an indoor source. But in some cases, they are when we have an indoor source. But in most, they're not. Let's move on to slide number 20, where I'd like to just talk a bit about the efficiency of these vapor removal systems. As you can see from the pie chart on the left, it shows the contaminant of concerns at the base and the frequency of detection before the vapor removal system is installed. And as you can see, as I said, the major contaminant of concern is TCE. And before the systems are installed, we have detections of TCE both above the mitigation action level and below the mitigation action level, a large percentage of detections. Once the vapor removal system is installed, as you can see from the pie chart on the right, most of the contaminants of concern, then most of the concentrations of the contaminants of concern then fall below the mitigation action level. However, we do have some outliers. We do have some interior sources. We do have some vapor removal systems that have been installed where it's not a vapor intrusion problem, but an indoor source problem. And so we have low efficiency on those types of situations. And there's examples of some other situations where we have less than 100% efficiency. But basically, most of the systems are operating at 90% or better efficiency. Okay, let's move on to slide number 21. Well, I'll just give you some basic cost information on the system. Typically, the cost for installing one of these systems is between $5,000 to $10,000 for a simple sub-slab depressurization system. It can go up as high as $30,000 if we have a complex case. And by complex case is if we maybe have to take multiple sampling before we confirm that vapor intrusion is a problem, or say if we have to install multiple suction points with the vapor removal system, such as maybe have a point in the basement, a suction point in the basement, and a suction point in the crawl space, and so forth. And it depends on how we vent the system, whether we vent it through the roof or through the outdoors. All of that can affect the cost and the complexity of each system. The advantages of the system is that we have a successful track rate with these systems working at 90% or better efficiency. And the other, of course, advantage is that the technology is applicable to a wide variety of site conditions and geology. And it can be applied to new homes or to new homes and existing structures. Okay, let's move on to slide number 22. This slide shows the mitigation results that basically led us to predict that we were seeing indoor sources versus vapor intrusion from the subsurface or from the groundwater plumes. As you can see from this chart, before a vapor removal system is installed, we have concentrations above the mitigation action level. And then once the system is installed, basically, there is a reduction in the concentration. Most of the detections are below the mitigation action level, but we still have detections slightly below the mitigation action level, which is not what we would expect. If there wasn't an indoor source, we would expect the concentrations to be much lower if there was not an indoor source. Okay, let's move on to slide number 23. Okay, this slide basically shows how to distinguish between an indoor source and a subsurface source, which is really a vapor intrusion problem. The chart on the slide on the left basically shows a decrease in the frequency of TCE and in the concentration of TCE after we put in the mitigation system. The blue line, the blue vertical line represents the point in time when we put the system in. And as you can see, the detections and the concentration levels before and after, and you can see that it's a general decline for TCE. So that tells us that it's probably a real vapor intrusion problem from the subsurface. As you can see from the chart on the right, and the contaminant concern in this case is 1,2-DCA. Before the system was put in, we didn't have the frequency and the concentration, as you can see, tends to increase after we put in the system. This indicates that it's probably an interior source, and which we found that most of our 1,2-DCA detections were interior sources. And Annette is going to get into that in more detail. Okay, let's move on now to slide number 24. Well, briefly discuss the challenges and ways to optimize the vapor intrusion program, ways that we've been looking at to optimize the program. Basically, we want to optimize our program in terms of how we manage it. We want to optimize our monitoring of indoor air. We want to optimize the mitigation. We don't want to put mitigation systems in if there's not a vapor intrusion problem, because this only incurs costs, more costs. And so basically, our two major challenges that we see are the interior sources and temporal variability as well as spatial variability, just basically variability in the concentrations. And Annette will discuss in more detail the specifics of Hill Air Force Base's experiences and lessons learned from dealing with these two challenges. Okay, now I'd just like to touch briefly on slide number 25 on the community involvement program at Hill Air Force Base. In general, Hill has done a tremendous job in terms of community involvement and community engagement. The public has a very favorable opinion on the cleanup efforts and progress that Hill Air Force Base has been making. And this is the same for the vapor intrusion pathway. Even though we have residences with vapor intrusion problems, they are very satisfied with the approach that has been taken. And this is because Hill has a strong community outreach where they do a lot to actually get out and inform and prepare the public to make sure that the public is knowledgeable of the risks associated with this pathway. We have various informational meetings. They send out annual letters and emails on the program. The monitoring results for the indoor air samples are shared with the community as soon as possible, and so forth. A lot of community outreach activities. Now, I'd also like to talk a little bit about the access issues for monitoring. Of course, we have to have access to the homes because once we install the vapor removal systems, as I said, we have to go in on a yearly basis and conduct a yearly inspection of the system to make sure it's operating as designed. And we need access issues for that. So basically, what Hill Air Force does is they sign a license, they have a license agreement with the resident outlining the responsibilities of the resident, and it outlines the responsibilities of Hill Air Force Base and their requirements for accessing for the purpose of monitoring and maintaining the system. With the community involvement activities, we also like to make sure the public knows, is safe, and knows about the health and safety concerns of the system. And like I said before, the vapor, an added bonus to these vapor removal systems is that they do remove radon if that is occurring. Now I'd just like to talk a little bit about the claims process that's set in place in case we have residents that feel that their property values have decreased due to this vapor intrusion problem or due to them having a system installed in their homes. Basically, here is a claims process whereby residents who feel that they've been damaged can request compensation. And I'm just like to report out that no claims have been filed to date, and we haven't seen any drop in property values in the surrounding community. Okay, let's move on to slide number 26, where I'm going to give you a brief overview of the Hill Vapor Intrusion Program. In summary, there is a vapor intrusion problem at Hill Air Force Base. Vapor removal systems have been effective at reducing the concentrations below the mitigation action levels. And overall, there's a positive reaction from the residents. What would the reaction have been if we had chosen, say, the bottom-up approach versus the top-down approach? We don't know. But we do know that the residents do like the idea of knowing exactly what concentrations they're being exposed to. Also, indoor source is a problem when you take the approach of addressing the site from top down. It's a problem because there's a more of a potential to overestimate the vapor intrusion impacts. And we do have this problem at Hill. We initially did overestimate the vapor intrusion impacts before we started having more sophisticated methods to identify indoor sources. And of course, this can cause concern and frustration for the residents. Okay, let's move on to slide number 27, where I'd like to briefly discuss the decision logic for installing new and existing vapor removal systems. As I said, we have installed some vapor removal systems where there isn't a vapor intrusion problem, but it's an indoor source. So in the future, we really want to focus on minimizing the installation of unnecessary vapor removal systems. And we hope to do this by using multiple lines of evidence, by not only addressing the site from the top down, but also the bottom up, actually going in and taking more soil gas samples and more slab samples, so that we have multiple lines of evidence to actually indicate whether or not there is a vapor intrusion problem and not an indoor source. Okay, let's move on to slide number 28. We're going to briefly discuss exit strategies and recommendations. Basically, at what point do we turn off these vapor removal systems? How do we close off this pathway? Basically, what we are preparing to do is align the areas with the risk of vapor intrusion. Of course, the ultimate goal for exiting is to remediate the groundwater, which is causing the vapor intrusion problem. So that's our long-term goal, is to actually remediate the groundwater. The short-term is to remove the indoor air above the mitigation action levels, which is actually causing a health risk. And we do that by installing the vapor removal system. So basically, the design of the indoor air program implies that indoor air monitoring and mitigation will be required until either the groundwater underlying the area is cleaned up, or we can demonstrate that vapor intrusion is not occurring. This approach is both is proactive, is conservative, and is supported by the residents and other stakeholders. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to Annette, and she's going to get into the specific case study.
Good afternoon. I will be discussing case studies related to 1-2-DCA and area-by-area monitoring followed by pressure control, and then two examples, one of preferential flow sewer line and the second of a higher water table than usual. This first slide represents OU-8 and shows the TCE plume in the dark blue and the 1-2-DCA plume within the green line. Note on this slide that part of the plume area has TCE without 1-2-DCA. Initially, Hill was not aware of household products containing 1-2-DCA. This was a warning sign for us when we found it, that conditions change. Compounds come into favor and leave favor. Advance to slide 30. 1-2-DCA was detected only a few times early on in the program. The bar chart at top shows dramatic increase in the detection frequency of 1-2-DCA from 2004 to 2008. As vapor removal systems were not effective in reducing the concentration of 1-2-DCA, and as 1-2-DCA was detected in homes outside the plume boundaries shown as red circles, Hill initiated an indoor study to determine the source. Slide 31. The indoor source study identified 1-2-DCA in molded plastic Christmas decorations. To determine the molded plastics are a significant source at Hill using the GC mass spec. They were found in several homes. Slide 32. This slide presents the lines of evidence used at Hill to determine the source of the 1-2-DCA. First, Hill looked at the detection frequency over the plume versus not. As you can see from the chart, the concentration of 1-2-DCA not over the plume is greater than the detection over the plume, indicating an indoor source. Next, we compared the attenuation factor of 1-2-DCA to that of TCE. If vapor intrusion was occurring, you would expect the ratio of the concentration of the contaminant in groundwater to be similar to that in air. We found the concentration of 1-2-DCA in air to be 10 to 100 times greater than the concentration in groundwater, again indicating an indoor source. Then Hill used the J&E model to predict the concentration in the house. The concentration in the house was significantly higher than the model concentration, again indicating an interior source. As a result of this study, EPA and UDEQ concurred to remove 1-2-DCA from the contaminant list at Hill. Slide 33. To conduct an indoor source study, we use the portable GC mass spec, and I'll talk about the instrumentation, the approach, and example. Slide 34. The instrumentation. Hill uses the Infocon half-site GC mass spec to conduct the investigation. The HAP site was selected because the turnaround time was approximately 6 minutes. They got good separation of compounds using the select ion monitoring mode. They obtained positive identification and were able to obtain low detection limits in the parts per trillion. Slide 35. The approach of the indoor source study consists of conducting an area-by-area sampling of the residence, the basement, the main level, and the garage, and then following up in the area of the highest concentration to identify the source, room-by-room sampling, container survey sampling, and individual product survey sampling and emission rate. Slide 36. Once a consumer product containing the VOC of interest is identified, the area by area sampling approach was used. Here we isolated the potential source by the flux jar test, which takes approximately 2 minutes. This allowed us to measure the emission rate and then use the box model to calculate the expected concentration inside the home. Using this method, if the concentration is approximately the same, then the product is the primary source. If the concentration is considerably less than historically measured concentration, it suggests that other stronger sources are potentially present. Slide 37, please. I'm going to go quickly through the actual an actual home that we sampled. Doing the area-by-area testing, the results showed the highest PCE concentration observed upstairs to be 1.17 parts per billion by volume, and therefore we continued the investigation with the room-by-room sampling upstairs, shown in the next slide, 38. Results of the room-by-room sampling upstairs showed that the concentration was more than two times higher, or 2.56 parts per billion, in one upstairs room. Therefore, we focused the investigation on this room. In this case, the real-time survey mode was used to investigate a set of desk drawers. Slide 39, please. This slide shows the relative response of survey mode to four desk drawers. Based on a much higher response in drawer one, the drawer was open and adhesives containing PCE was identified. Slide 40. To confirm vapor intrusion, we isolated the entry point, removed household products adhesive in this case, as it has the potential to contaminate the subsurface air. Then we controlled the building pressure to determine the potential for vapor intrusion. Slide 41. During the interior source study, a total of 45 homes were investigated. Of those, 41 homes had interior sources, 2 were vapor intrusion related, and 2 were non-detects on the day of the investigation. A total of 233 household products containing a contaminant of concern have been identified. 63 are TCE, and 95 of those have been PCE. Slide 42. Now I'm going to discuss temporal variability. At Hill, we have observed two behaviors with respect to temporal variability in homes likely to have vapor intrusion. The steady type with high detection frequency and low variability, and the variable type with low detection frequency and high variability. Homes around Hill appear to be predominantly the variable type. A very small percentage, approximately or less than 15%, appear to be the steady type. Slide 43. This chart shows that from May to February, we observed the steady type vapor intrusion at Hill. It has a high detection frequency, 100% for TCE, and low concentration variability. This means that one sample provides a good indication that vapor intrusion is occurring and a good estimate of the exposure concentration. Next slide, please, 44. The top chart shows that from March to August, there was only one detection of TCE, whereas the lower chart shows that from November to March, the colder months, there were several detections. This demonstrates temporal variability and is unlikely to detect vapor intrusion and will be a poor indicator of exposure concentration. The variable type vapor intrusion is by far the more common of the two observed behaviors at Hill. This has cost and access implications. Cost due to the need for multiple samples to characterize and mitigate homes that are only above the action levels for a few days a year. An access issue as some residents do not continue to participate after one or more non-detect results, which could result in failure to identify impacted homes. Slide 45. Managing temporal variability. The variable type vapor intrusion poses a number of problems.
Again, I'm going to ask if you could please keep your phone lines on mute. If you don't have a mute button, please hit star 6 right now. I can hear a side conversation.
Variable type vapor intrusion poses a number of problems, such as access, multiple samples sometimes not possible, property owner only allows access once, false negative or positive results, and we're not referring to analytical data, but falsely concluding that vapor intrusion is occurring above the action levels when it isn't, or that vapor intrusion is not occurring when it is. At Hill, we manage temporal variability by using the HAP site to rule out interior sources and by controlling the variability with a building, the potential, and by controlling building pressure with a fan in the window to draw vapors into the house. The methods complete each other and take out spatial variability in addition to managing the temporal variability. Slide 46, please. Building pressure control. As you can see at the lower right, there's a window fan, a square window fan, box window fan in the window. Okay, by placing a box fan in the window and blowing air out of the house, you can induce a negative pressure. This allows us to confirm vapor intrusion. You can use the information to make decisions based on one sampling event, as it is the worst case, and you can move away from multiple lines of evidence. Next slide, slide 47. The upper figure shows differential pressure across the slab. With the fan off, the pressure is higher inside the building than the sub-slab pressure. Blow is out of the building and vapor intrusion cannot occur. With the fan on, the pressure is higher inside the subslab than in the building, or the building is depressurized, and vapor intrusion can occur. at Hill, if we control building pressure, then we can control vapor intrusion. The lower figure shows increasing concentrations of TCE in the home once it is depressurized. The overall point of this slide is that this home would have shown a non-detect if sampled without pressure control, leading to a false negative conclusion that this home is not impacted by vapor intrusion. With pressure control, the potential vapor intrusion is evident. For this case, we took it one step further to see if we could identify the main vapor entry pathway, which is the next slide, 48. This is an example of room-by-room sampling before and during depressurization. The blue highlight is the baseline condition or initial concentration of TCE before pressure control. The yellow highlight is after the home has been depressurized. Overall, you can clearly see higher concentrations downstairs and a very high concentration in a storage area under the stairs, 29 parts per billion by volume. And then the inset at the top is approximately 130 parts per billion, and that's an entry point. A large crack between the foundation slab and the wall appears to be a significant source of vapor entry. This is good to know because if enough of the crack is accessible, mitigation can be accomplished by sealing the crack. In the case of this home, not very much of the crack was accessible because the basement is finished. Slide 49. This is a flow chart of the investigation strategy used at Hill Air Force Base. An indicator compound, usually the most likely to occur in the area, is used for the purpose of the test. Once we sample the area by area garage, main, and basement levels, if we get a detection, then we sample room by room, followed by container and entry point sampling. If an interior source is identified, then an emission test is conducted to determine the primary source. The resident is asked to remove the source and Hill then depressurizes the building to determine the potential for vapor intrusion. The result is compared to the standard or an average or maximum. Slide 50. This slide is an example of preferential flow resulting from a water discharge to the sanitary sewer. This is a map of OU1 and 2 and the treatment systems in the South Weaver sewer system. There are four sample locations and they're in bold. That's the North Interceptor Trench, which is upstream, the number one, number two, and number three. Number two is the highest point and the flow is in both directions. The problem, water containing chemicals from groundwater cleanup systems. The red line is Hill's discharge line, and the elevation of this line drops approximately 300 feet. The greenish-yellow line is the sanitary sewer line. The problem, water containing chemicals from groundwater cleanup systems, is discharged to the sewer where the chemicals volatilize and move as vapors through the sewer lines. This volatilization process is enhanced by turbulence in the water as it drops 300 feet through a series of manholes. At least only one home has been confirmed to have vapor intrusion, but several others are suspected. Combined concentrations of these chemicals have temporarily been above regulatory thresholds in the home. Slide 51. the solution is to reduce the chemical concentration in the discharged water or remove the associated vapors from the sewer line. Hill determined that removing the vapors from the sewer line to be the most effective solution. And that was determined after depressurization test using a low-pressure fan that was placed above manhole number one to remove the vapors prior to reaching the South Weaver City sewer line and to determine the effectiveness of the approach. This test resulted in a tenfold drop in the chemical concentration within 2 hours of startup, and these reductions were observed more than 300 meters or 1,000 feet downstream.
Catch you later.
Based on this test, Hill believes a permanent fan system located further upstream at the North Interceptor Trench, or NIT, will be even more effective. Slide 52. This is an example of vapor intrusion due to higher water table than in previous years. The map is of OU5. The location of the residence is over 1,000 feet up gradient of the groundwater containment system shown in the larger black square and a bit farther down gradient shown in the smaller black square. And the resident is over the portion of the TCE plume with the highest concentrations in the groundwater, which are 100 to 100,000 parts per billion. The problem, we had backup of water in a basement at a resident's home, and he was concerned that it was due to a failure of the containment and treatment system. Hill reviewed the groundwater monitoring data and determined the water table was higher than in previous years. Hill also sampled and found chlorine and chloroform in the water, indicating it was from municipal water. This was confirmed by the residents, who talked to the utilities department at the city. Preliminary results showed TCE in both the sump water and in the air, and Hill has strongly encouraged the residents to participate in the Hill sampling program. Slide 53, the key point. Hill chose to sample inside air for vapor intrusion characterization. It has been determined in some homes, indoor sources are very problematic. The public reaction to the top-down approach has been generally favorable, and we would choose indoor sampling approach again. One other thing is do your homework. We have more vapor removal systems installed than are probably necessary due to the fact we started early on and the sources are due to indoor air. I guess one other thing I need to mention is we had suggested that better water table characterization be done also, because what matters for vapor intrusion is characterization at the water table level. Thank you. Oh, I would like to again recognize Kyle Gorder and Eric Dettenmeyer, who are on the phone, and they are the Hill Air Force Base project managers for the vapor intrusion and indoor air program, and they will help field questions. And the next slide, slide number 55, is reference material authored by both Eric and Kyle if you need further information. So questions.
Hello? Hello?
God. Hello?
You call him back and I'm going to go see.
What happened?
I don't know.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh. Are you guys still there for the webinar?
I am.
Is Gene still on the line?
I'm sorry, guys. I was here. I had a phone glitch on my end. My apologies. I'm still here. So I want to thank you guys for bringing everybody to slide number 56, which is the point where we're going to break and take questions from the audience. For those of you who are streaming the audio and have already typed up an electronic question or comment, I do have a whole series of those that have been submitted, and we will get to those in just a few seconds. You may continue to use that question mark icon to allow a new window to pop up so you can type up your comment or question, and I will read those out loud in just a few moments on your behalf to our instructors. But before I turn to those electronic questions and to give you some more time to type them up, I'm going to start with our phone line participants. If you are on the phone line, this is just a reminder. I can still hear someone else having a side conversation, so I'm not sure if they're in the room with the presenters or not. But I will ask you and remind you, if you do not have a question and you are not a presenter, please keep your phone line on mute. Even if you think you're muted, you're not. So please hit *6 to mute your phone now. For those of you on the phones who do have a question, you are welcome to unmute to ask your question at this time. If you've used your own mute button, simply hit mute button to unmute yourself or hit *6 to unmute your line. We'd ask that you at least identify your organization and then ask your question. Okay, since I don't hear anything coming in from the telephone line participants, I'm going to switch to the streaming audio questions that have come in. And the first one comes in from Atlanta, Georgia. And they're asking, are you willing to share a copy of an example letter that you sent to the residences requesting sampling of their home?
I'm sure Hill would agree to that. I don't think that will be any problem.
Okay, and to facilitate that, I can do a few things. I can provide the person's contact information to you guys in Region 8, or if you can get a copy of that letter from Hill, we can also post it on the resources page for the seminar. So whatever you prefer to do, just let me know.
Okay.
Thanks. The next question is coming in from Malvern, Pennsylvania, and they ask, what criteria were used to establish the priority order for sampling the 2,900 residences?
If it was over the shallow groundwater and in the areas where we have the groundwater plumes.
Yeah, we basically tried to focus first on the homes that were overlying the groundwater plumes. That was our first priority. And then if we have a detection, then we step out 100 feet from that. And that's basically how we identify the affected area initially.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and they state, after initial sampling in the homes, I think the speaker said that indoor sources were eliminated, and then the homeowner had to wait 1 year for further sampling, and if positive, to then get a vapor intrusion system installed. If that is correct, that means that the homeowner had to live with the vapors for over a year. Is this correct? If so, I think they must have been harmed. And they're looking for comments on that.
I'm sorry, can you restate that question?
Again, the question comes in from Milwaukee, and they state, after initial sampling in the homes, I think the speaker said that indoor sources were eliminated, and then the homeowner had to wait 1 year for further sampling, and if positive, to then get a vapor intrusion system installed. If that's correct, that would mean that the homeowner had to live with vapors in their house for over a year. If so, they must have been harmed. So they're looking for comments if that was correct, if they did live in the home with vapors for over a year while you were testing, and were they adversely impacted by those vapors?
No, that's not correct. If an interior source was found, we asked the residents to remove it. Then we went back in and did further testing to determine whether there was vapor intrusion. and we would follow up with annual sampling after that.
Right. After the indoor source investigation, if there is an indoor source, we remove it. Then we follow up right away to see if there is indeed a vapor intrusion problem. If at that particular point in time there is not, then we follow up the next year.
Okay, great. The next question is coming in from Malvern, Pennsylvania, and they ask, what differences in concentrations, and this is in order of magnitude, for the VOCs, if any, were observed in the indoor and substab samples collected during warmer versus colder months from the same sample point?
There are significantly more detections of the contaminants during the colder months than there are during the warmer months. One of the slides I presented showed that we only got one detection during the warmer months. And the concentrations are also lower during if you're getting mostly non-detects, of course the concentrations are a lot lower during the warmer months.
Yeah, and so as a result, we basically do most of our sampling in the colder months, from October through April, generally, of the year, mainly focusing on the colder months, trying to get as much sampling as possible done during those colder months.
Okay, great. The next question is also coming in from Pennsylvania, and they ask, how is 90% or better efficiency defined for the remediation systems? Specific compound concentration reduction from the initial detection level or something else?
Now, I talked about the efficiency of the systems, and we basically look at a number of factors when we look at the efficiency of the system. First, we want to make sure that it was installed properly before we start testing for efficiency. But basically, if there is a vapor intrusion problem, and once the system is turned on, if we see a significant reduction concern, then we can make an efficiency determination from that.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Atlanta, Georgia, and they ask, have there been any models created that project how long the subslab depressurization systems will need to be present at their homes, or in general, how long will the vapor intrusion be a concern? They'd also like to know how the offsite groundwater plume is being addressed.
That's something that we're constantly working on, is evaluating the data and collecting more data to make a determination for how long we have to run these vapor removal systems and when can we shut them off. So we're working together, all three parties, to develop clear and distinct exit strategies for closure of the systems. And ultimately, of course, one of two things in order to be able to close this pathway out, we have to, first of all, clean up the groundwater contamination, and in the short term, just ensure that the public is not coming into contact with any health-related exposure concentration.
And as far as the off-site plumes, how is that? How are the plumes addressed? We have, as I showed in OU5, we have containment systems in there. We have a permeable reactive barrier and then a base boundary containment system. And then the summary sheet that Sandra showed.
Yeah,
it was
slide number 8, which is the summary sheet, and it lists all the different operable units. It lists the contaminants of concerns, and it also specifically lists the remediation systems that are in place for each operable unit to address the plumes. So if you can refer to slide number 8, I think that would address most of the second part of your question.
Excellent. The next question is actually coming in from Honolulu, Hawaii, and they ask, how is it decided to use a 10 to the -5 cancer risk action level rather than 10 to the -6 in residences?
The decision was made to use 10 to the -5 because that is basically from EPA guidance. And generally, the guidance recommends that because a lot of these health-based, a lot of these risk-based cost, mitigation action levels are very low, and basically what we find in a lot of incidents is that you have background, sometimes you have background concentrations of these vapors that are actually higher than the health-based concentrations. So that's why the 10 to the minus 5 was chosen over the 10 to the minus 6. We don't want to get into situations where we're cleaning up background VOC concentrations.
Okay. The next question is an anonymous question, and they ask, have any buildings inside Hill Air Force Base been sampled for vapor intrusion?
Yes, we have sampled those. We did it in a Patriot Hills. We did also industrial buildings. I think there's been about 300 samples taken on base, and we have not found the contamination in the indoor air there, primarily because
the depth of groundwater is so deep. On base, the depth of groundwater is generally 100 or more feet below ground surface. So we tend, so far we have not come into, we have not experienced any vapor intrusion problems on base.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. How long must a VI system run in a home in cases like this before you get a non-detect? Would that take years? Would it take forever?
I think that will be site by site. We think once we can remove the groundwater, we will be able to remediate it completely. We will be able to remove some the VI systems.
Yeah, that's a question that you know, we can't definitely pinpoint an answer to at this time because we're still addressing this pathway. As I said, the first system was installed in 2002. This is 2011. What is that, 9 years? So we've had systems running out there for 9 years or less, and we have not shut off any systems to date that I am aware of.
Okay. The next question comes in from Kansas City, and they ask, how many homes have sold since the mitigation systems were installed?
As I stated in the presentation, we have not seen any problems with residents selling their homes due to the vapor intrusion pathway or due to them having a vapor removal system in their homes. And in some cases, it's been just the opposite. The homes with the vapor with the vapor removal systems installed sometimes seems to sell quicker than the ones that don't have a system. It's seen as a positive aspect.
Okay. The next question comes in from Columbia, South Carolina, and they ask, how has Hill Air Force Base balanced collecting vapor intrusion samples while moving forward with groundwater remediation if groundwater remediation has been started at Hill?
Well, of course, our first focus was on remediating the groundwater plumes, and we are continuing to do that. We're now focused, aware of, and focused on the vapor intrusion problem, and we are addressing both pathways together. We plan to have meetings to decide how we're going to combine these two pathways. Some of our OUs, the vapor intrusion pathway was not included in the ROD. We may have to go back and say maybe do an ESD or a ROD amendment and maybe incorporate that pathway, how we are addressing that pathway in the ROD. Or we may address the vapor intrusion pathway as one overall OU that addresses the pathway in the air media. So we're still in discussions on how to handle that and reach site closure, but we are addressing both pathways for all OUs.
Okay. The next question is coming in from Denver, Colorado, and they're referencing slide number 40 in the presentation. And they say that slide 40 displays sampling of isolated vapor intrusion entry points. It appears that different types of tape, for example, duct and blue masking tape, are used to isolate the entry points. Are there concerns with the tape adhesive? Or how are potential impacts from the tape adhesives addressed?
Kyle, can you address that?
Sure, yeah. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, there are concerns with the adhesives in the tape. Specifically, if you were looking for, BTEX compounds, a lot of tapes will have toluene in them. So it's sort of like any other sampling. You have to be careful and do sort of a method blank type analysis. And we happen to know that both the painter's tape that you see in these pictures that we use to protect, nice surfaces in people's houses and the duct tape that we use do not emit any of the compounds of concern for our investigation. So they don't contain chlorinated VOCs that you saw on the MDL list.
Okay. The next question, also coming in from Denver, Colorado. They ask, has the North Interceptor Trench vapor removal system been installed to date? And if not, has a pilot study been completed?
Has it been installed? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The next question comes in from Springfield, Massachusetts. They say, can you give an estimate of the cost, and in parentheses, per sample or per day for the portable GCMS?
The cost per sample ranges usually between $5 to $10 for the main cost for that is just for the purchasing of equipment, but the cost per sample is only $5 to $10.
Okay. The next question comes in from Columbia, South Carolina. Was there any VI study done at a local business, or is the groundwater plume only below residential areas?
Kyle?
Yes. We have done a few businesses, and Eric might actually be able to give a better number than I can, and I have a little bit of a background noise problem here, too. We have done a few businesses, but 99% of the sampling we've done and the impacted buildings over the plume are residential properties. Eric, if you want to add a bit more detail to that, jump in, and if not, I'm going to assume that's the best answer that we can give to that question.
Yeah, that's pretty much the right answer. The only buildings that would be similar to commercial buildings would be, we have a couple of elementary schools that we sample on a quarterly basis.
Okay. The next question is coming in from Park City, Utah, and they ask, can the portable GCMS instrument be used in place of laboratory analysis of a 24-hour Sumacan indoor air samples? Or is the portable GCMS instrument only used after the results of indoor air samples are obtained to investigate the location of the specific source of indoor air contamination?
I believe it's after you use the 24-hour Suma canister.
Yes, it's definitely after, and it's mainly for indoor source identification.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Malvern, Pennsylvania. Have any DNAPLs been encountered in the soils and or groundwater with respect to the potential need for DNAPL source remediation?
There are a couple of OUs on base where we do have, most of the plumes have DNAPLs, and in particular OU2, I believe. And we've done a lot of source removal of the DNAPL at OU2. And we've done that by means of surfactant enhanced remediation. There's been a lot of studies on that in the past years. So we have done some work using innovative technologies to remove at actual DNAPLs.
Okay. And again, the last question I have online is coming in from Park City, Utah. and they ask, did you ever collect effluent vapor samples from the sub-slab depressurization system? Was any consideration ever given to the need to remediate effluent vapor from these systems?
Okay, could you repeat that, please?
Again, the first question asks, did you ever collect effluent vapor samples from the sub-slab depressurization systems? The next question.
I do believe we have, and I think Colin Eric can expand on that.
Yeah, this is Kyle. We have collected that, but sort of informally. We don't do it as part of the routine vapor intrusion sampling program. And as far as the second question goes, whether there was any consideration of need to treat that vapor, I believe, and Sandra maybe can help with this part, I believe that very early in the program, it was determined that the concentrations in the effluent from the VRSs would be well below any of the effluent discharge limits, air discharge limits here in the state of Utah. I also wanted to add on the Park City commenter from before with respect to how we use the vapor or the portable GCMS. The answer was correct that currently we only use that as a follow-up to Sumacan sampling. But the truth of the matter is the instrument functions the exact same as a laboratory GCMS. There's no reason why it can't provide the same quality of data that you get from a laboratory, and theoretically could be used in lieu of laboratory sampling, but we're not currently using it in that way. So I think I answered all of those questions. If not, Park City can ask again, and we'll clarify some more. Thanks.
Okay, great. We do have some additional time allotted with our session today, so I'm going to switch back over to the phone lines to see if anyone on the phone has any questions or comments. While we deal with the phone lines, those of you who are streaming audio, you can continue to type up comments, questions, or even clarify previously submitted questions using the question mark icon that appears at the top of your slides. So for those of you, though, in the meantime on the phone lines, if you have a question, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute. You may need to hit #6 so that you can locally unmute your line. And then please be sure to identify yourself or organization and then ask your question. Okay, and I don't see any other electronic questions or comments that are coming in right now at this point. So I want to go back to our presenters in Region 8, see if there are any closing statements or comments that you'd like to make.
I guess the only comment I would like to make is the lessons learned, do your homework. Otherwise, you can get into a costly situation. We've found out that doing the area-by-area sampling followed by controlling the pressure in the buildings, we can determine if vapor intrusion is occurring and reduce the sampling effort needed for the vapor intrusion control.
Okay. While you were actually making that statement, I had two more questions come in online, so I'm going to go ahead and read those because we do have some time left. So one of those questions is coming in from Columbia, South Carolina, and they ask, during the on-base sampling, were the same parameters used for these industrial buildings compared to the off-base residential houses? Specifically, were the structures of the buildings taken into account? For example, more airflow in industrial buildings.
Kyle?
Yes, there were different factors. There are different factors that we take into account when we were addressing the industrial buildings on base. Most industrial buildings can have different type of air exchange rates and so forth, different ventilation and type. So it is a somewhat different approach. And of course, in the industrial buildings, there's different types of risks that you have to look at. There's different type of operations that occur in the buildings on base. You can have workers who are working in office settings. You have waste storage in some of the buildings, which leads to more interior sources. It's just more of a wide variety of situations that we encounter with industrial buildings and buildings on base as opposed to residential areas.
Okay. The next question is coming in from Park City, Utah, and they ask, did you install any passive venting systems? If so, were they effective?
I'm not aware of any passive venting systems that have been installed to date. However, the three parties, HIL, EPA, and UDEQ, we have discussed possibly doing this in the future, and basically for any new structures that would be built, especially we're thinking on base where we have more control, we would construct and build them with a type of passive venting system so that we wouldn't run into the vapor intrusion problems. So it has been discussed and we are aware of it.
Okay. And the last question that I see coming in is coming in from Pennsylvania, and they were asking how the U.S. EPA and the state of Utah interfaced from the regulatory perspective.
We interfaced when we were developing the mitigation, the site-specific mitigation action levels for Hill Air Force Base. Both regulators tapped into their resources in terms of toxicological support and working with the guidance and EPA headquarters to develop the site-specific mitigation action levels that we use at Hill Air Force Base. So we interact and interface and collaborate on a daily basis. We have a very strong partner relationship has been developed between EPA and the state of Utah. And if our UDEQ project manager, Mr. Mohammed Slam, is on the line, he can expand on that. But I think he's listening by way of the computer, so he may not be able to expand on that.
Okay, if you're on the phone lines, you need to unmute your phone. You may have to hit #6 to unmute and go ahead and speak up. Okay, well, I do have another question that actually was submitted, and they asked from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, did you need Clean Air Act permits for this project?
No.
Okay. Again, one last check to see if anybody else on the phone lines has a comment or question. Again, you may have to hit #6 to unmute to identify yourself. Okay, and if there are no further closing statements or closing comments from those in Region 8?
We don't have any.
Okay, great. Thanks. Then what I will do is direct everyone along to slide number 57 to start the formal closeout procedure for today's session. On slide number 57, which is the final slide in your packet, there are two important resources or links available. The first one is an additional resources page where you can actually not only download today's PowerPoint presentation, but look at a collection of other resources that are related to today's topic. And we may post additional resources there if they become available from the organizers. The second link is a short feedback form, so we would ask you to take just a minute to fill it out. It's not too many questions, and please know that I do read each and every one of those. If you did experience technical problems today, you weren't able to access the slides, you can certainly comment on that in the feedback form. We are aware of that glitch, and we do apologize immensely for any confusion or inconvenience that it caused, but we were able to resolve the issue, and I think got in touch with a few people that were having problems. But we do count on your feedback to ensure that we can continue to offer such free online training through CLUIN. If you shared the line with a number of participants, each individual person can take their own turn to fill out the feedback form. Once you fill out the form, there will be a link that will appear to let the next person sign on and fill out their own feedback form. If you're looking for credit for your participation today, we don't offer CEUs or PEHs on CLUIN. However, some accrediting institutions will accept copies of the PowerPoint material along with a registration email or a confirmation email after submitting feedback. So when you fill out feedback, there's actually a box you can check to have a confirmation email sent to you for your records. And again, each individual person can fill that form out and ask for their own confirmation email that may help you earn credit for today's session. If you're not sitting in front of a computer or have a printed copy, those very same links are available on the bottom of the seminar homepage. Again, links to feedback and links to the resources. And those links will continue to remain active after today's session. So you can certainly come back in the next day or so and fill out feedback if that's more convenient for you. With that, I will extend my thanks to our presenters from EPA Region 8, as well as our organizers who helped put together the NARPM Presents Seminar Series. I want to thank all of our participants. We had over 120 people from all over the U.S. participate today. I do, again, apologize for the technical issues we encountered at the start of today's session, but I appreciate you guys sticking with us while we resolved them and hanging in there so we were able to completely deliver the session today. Again, I hope that you'll participate on a future Clue and Internet seminar sometime soon. And again, when we're ready to post the archives, so if you did encounter technical difficulties, the entire thing was recorded. Everyone who registered will automatically receive an email with the complete recording available to them. So you can certainly catch whatever you may have missed or pass it along to someone that you think may find it useful. So again, thank you to all of you who participated today, and I hope to either see you or hear from you on a future Clue and Internet seminar. This will be the formal conclusion for today's session. Thank you, and have a great rest of your day.